From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Nicole Blanchard, the Idaho Statesman's outdoors reporter, Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
All right. Let's start with the legislature as it officially wrapped up this week after 94 days in session. So, Kevin, I want to begin today's conversation with a pretty controversial library bill that Governor Little signed into law. Can you start off by telling us about this bill and then what it means now that it will become law?
Well, first of all, after 94 days, the end of the legislative session is the most wonderful time of the year. And I think Scott will agree to that. And Nicole.
Agreed.
The library law, which is now in effect, this is a three-year debate. And we've talked about it so much over the past 3 years. What this would do now that it's law is it's going to require school and public libraries to take steps to restrict kids' access to materials that are deemed harmful to minors. The big crux of this bill is that it does allow parents to file a complaint to ask for removal of these books, and it allows parents to seek a civil damage. A private cause of action is the term that gets used at the State House for these bills a lot. It allows parents to get a $250 fine from a library if the library is found in violation of this law. Plus, they can seek damages. So $250 is not necessarily the cap. It's all interesting, Gemma, because we've had this debate now for 3 years. The end of last legislative session, Governor Little vetoed a library bill. And one of his big reasons for vetoing it was that he didn't like the private cause of action. He didn't like allowing parents to seek damages like that. He called it a bounty. Well, this bill, now law, does have a bounty. It may not be as high a bounty as it was a year ago. I think it was $2,500 last year. Now we're down to $250. A bounty is still a bounty, but this one was one that apparently was low enough that the governor felt he could sign it into law. Not enthusiastically. I mean, as he famously told Logan Finney from Idaho Reports on Wednesday, I signed that stinking library bill. So not exactly rave reviews from the governor, but it is law now, and it's going to be very interesting now after 3 years of debate to see what does that mean for public libraries, for school libraries. Well, what's going to happen now in the implementation phase? Is it going to cost money to figure out how to segregate books? Is there the possibility that libraries are going to get going to face fines? We don't really know how this is all going to play out.
And what about the possibility of any types of lawsuits around this, Kevin? I mean, I'm wondering about, you know, simple things like free speech.
I think there's always a possibility that this is going to wind up in court. I think you could say that about a couple of bills that the governor signed into law this week. One that would also, it involves pronouns, the use of pronouns in schools, and says that a teacher would not be compelled to refer to a student by the pronoun that they prefer if that pronoun does not align with their birth gender. I think that law, which Governor Little signed, I believe, on Monday, I think that one is destined to wind up in the courts as well.
Scott, your editorial board published an article earlier this week calling it the good and the bad of the session. Can you give us a roundup of what stood out to you this session?
Yeah, we call it the good, the bad, and the ugly of the session. And so I'll start with the bad and the ugly so that I can end on a high note. As can be expected, it seems like every year we'll have some sort of embarrassing headlines out of the session. You know, this year was no exception. Probably one of the top ones was the cannibalism bill, anti-cannibalism bill. Of course, we all oppose cannibalism and we would oppose tricking someone into eating human flesh. But apparently we have a law against it because Representative Heather Scott saw a video on a plane of somebody being tricked into eating human flesh. Well, it turns out that was a hoax. It was a joke video, and it didn't really happen. But nonetheless, we have a bill on that. We also had kind of an ugly situation with an effort to decry racism in Idaho. During the session, as you might probably all recall, there was a racial verbal attack against the University of Utah women's basketball team who were staying in Coeur d'Alene. And so Senator Abby Lee felt it was necessary to bring a resolution to the legislature to decry racism based on this incident, and you know, make a statement to the world that this is not, that we don't condone this. The resolution did pass, but there were some far right legislators who just had a really hard time accepting it, despite testimony of three witnesses to the incident. They wanted hard, fast proof before they could decry racism. So that was kind of an ugly stain on the session. Another ugly incident was the summer EBT program. This is a $16 million federal grant that would have fed children over the summer. The legislature killed it on arguments that they were afraid that rich kids might abuse the system, or that poor children need to work for what they get. And so that was kind of an ugly thing. As Kevin mentioned before, the pronouns bill allows teachers to not use a student's preferred pronouns. And that, like Kevin said, probably is headed for litigation. They also passed a bill that incorrectly conflates the definitions of sex and gender. Again, there's, you know, every session for the last 4 years, at least, we've had these attacks on transgender rights. And this year was no exception. Another bad incident was the short-lived tenure of Representative Megan Blanksma as House Majority Leader, because she opposed the changes to the way the Budget Committee was doing budgets this year. And something that the legislature failed to do this year was protect or change Idaho's abortion laws. You know, Idaho has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country, and it's sowing confusion and fears in the medical community. It's leading doctors and patients to flee the state, and really, legislators did nothing about it. I'll also point out they didn't do anything about the grocery sales tax either. Another, you know, let's keep that on the radar. We already mentioned the library books ban and bounty bill, as I like to call it, the ITD, Idaho Transportation Department headquarters property, which we'll talk a little bit later. They killed a deal that was already approved, and we'll get into more details about that. So all that said, we did have some good highlights. There were some good points to the legislative session this year. Probably primary among them was the school facilities funding. This is a $2 billion with a B funding package over 10 years, state funding for school facilities. The dire state of some of our school facilities in the state were highlighted in a year-long investigation in the Statesman in partnership with ProPublica. And the governor proposed this $2 billion plan to get school facilities up to par throughout the state. And that did pass after a little bit of wrangling, but that did pass. Legislators also passed a bill to require insurers to provide at least a 6-month supply of prescribed contraceptives, which, you know, should be a no-brainer in a state that bans abortions. If you want fewer unplanned pregnancies, increase the availability of contraception. Something that kind of flew under the radar this session was an agricultural protection area bill. We talk about losing farmland in the state. Well, the legislature passed overwhelmingly a bill that provides landowners with an additional option when considering protecting agricultural land in the state. And then they stymied a bunch of really bad bills. They killed a bill to repeal voter-approved Medicaid expansion. They killed a bill to force school districts to allow employees to carry guns in school. They killed a bill from Representative Julianne Young that would have changed the definition of embryo or fetus to preborn child. And they killed a bill to give tax credits to people who don't want to send their children to taxpayer-funded public schools. So that was kind of, that was what we saw from the editorial board, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin, you wrote a similar piece in regards to education at the State House during this last session. In fact, you called the session chaotic. So what stood out to you when we're looking at the educational front. I mean, Scott did just bring up the fact that a school choice bill was actually, you know, not put into law.
Right. I would say that the two biggest things that did happen in education, and Scott talked about it already, the facilities law. You had this huge implementation now of what we're going to do at the school level with this infusion of money for facilities and how does it address needs. But a big and historic investment at the state level in local schools. That was one of the big things that happened this session on education. The other was funding Idaho Launch. There was some debate about that, and there was some pushback about that. But the bottom line is $70 million is going to go out now for high school graduates, this year's high school graduates, so that they can go to trade school, they can go into mm-hmm. career technical education, or they can go to two-year school or four-year school to begin to pursue in-demand careers. Those are the two biggest things that I think happened, that did happen on education. The two biggest things that didn't happen on education, well, you alluded to it, the tax credit bill that would have put $50 million into private school tax credits, that died in the House committee. Issue's not going to go away, I doubt, but it did go away for this session. The other thing that did not happen, the legislature did not sign on, very resoundingly did not sign on to the University of Idaho's plans to buy the University of Phoenix. Both houses went on record saying they have real reservations about the transaction. Transaction is very much in limbo at this point.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, let me bring you into the conversation, getting out of the legislature for a moment. There is a case that's heading to the U.S. Supreme Court to hear oral arguments, and this could have really big impacts on Idaho when it comes to abortion care. So can you quickly just tell us about this case?
Sure, Gemma. So Scott mentioned a little bit ago that we have, you know, some of the strictest abortion laws in the country, and this case has to do with a lack of an exception that we have. So here in Idaho, you can have an abortion if you are a pregnant patient and your life is at risk because of your pregnancy. But if your health is at risk, there's no exception for that. And doctors have said that that's been very difficult for them to kind of distinguish where that line is. They're having to kind of wait for patients to really decline before they can make that call. So shortly after that really strict law went into effect in 2022, the federal Department of Justice sued the state of Idaho and said, hey, there's this, you know, Emergency Labor Act that you are actually violating. It requires that patients experiencing a medical emergency get care. And if you're not allowing people to have an abortion when they're experiencing an emergency, and that is the stabilizing treatment, then you're violating that federal law. So that's sort of where we're at. That's the argument that's at the center of this.
So Nicole, some conservative think tank groups filed an amicus brief this week in regards to this case. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so we have seen so far 45 of these amicus briefs, which are, they're also called friend of the court briefs. It's basically interested parties who will kind of give their side of the story or their interest to the court. They can provide some additional legal arguments, some additional perspective on the impacts of the outcome of this case. So we've had 45 of those, and about 18 of them were from people who are in support of Idaho saying, you know, we shouldn't have this emergency exception for the health of a pregnant patient. And a lot mm-hmm. of those came from kind of national conservative think tanks, religious groups, things like that. So we've got a lot of organizations affiliated with the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church. We had some conservative groups like the Manhattan Institute. More locally, we had the Idaho Family Policy Center. So a lot of these folks kind of jumping in and saying, we object to the EMTALA argument. So EMTALA is the name of that federal emergency law, but we mm-hmm. object to it based on quite a few different arguments, if you want me to get into that as well.
And it, quickly, if you could, before we go into break, so people might have a broader understanding.
Sure. So the main argument is that this emergency law doesn't supersede state law. So that's really going to be mm-hmm. for the justices to kind of figure out whether they think that the federal law the federal government or the state government kind of has precedence in this situation. But we also saw a lot of argument from particularly the religious organizations that having physicians perform an abortion if it violates their religious beliefs or their conscience, that that could potentially be an issue. So we also had some medical groups, like some pro-life obstetrician and gynecologist groups, that said that abortion isn't necessary to stabilize a patient in an emergency. And all of those things, you know, were refuted in some of these other amicus briefs, which we will have some stories coming out about some of those other briefs in the future. But those are some of the arguments that are being made.
Okay, appreciate it. And those oral arguments are happening is it next week. Is that correct?
It is a week and a half from today. So it'll be on April 24th.
All right. So, Scott, lots of back and forth amongst legislators before the session wrapped up concerning the former Idaho Transportation Department campus on State Street in Boise. You touched on it briefly the last segment, but let's get into this a little bit more, because Governor Little came out calling this unfair. But can you, fill us in on what's been happening in regards to this campus, and then why the governor would say that and then do what he did?
Right. Yeah, so this is the 44-acre campus, ITD headquarters campus on State Street, between State Street and the river and the Greenbelt. And, you know, we've known for a long time that the transportation department was going to move out of there. The state of Idaho several years ago purchased the HP campus on Chinden several years ago, and we're planning on moving all their state employees over to that campus, including the Idaho Transportation Department. 2 years ago, ITD announced that they were selling that property. They're going to put it up for sale. And at the time, it generated a lot of buzz. This was, you know, considered one of the most prime pieces of development, if not the most prime piece of development in the state of Idaho. And there was a lot of buzz about it. They put it out for bid. They went through, and people don't remember this, but they put it out for bid and they got a round of bidders, but it wasn't high enough. They didn't get any bids that were high enough. And so they canceled it and went back to the drawing board and redid it, put it out for bid again. And in September of 2023, last year, they got another round of bids from nine bidders, and they got a high bid of $51.8 million to sell the land. And, you know, legislators were, I guess, not pleased with that amount. You know, some time ago, ITD had estimated that the value of that property would be $80 million to $100 million. I don't know if that was realistic or where those numbers really came from, but that was one of the things that legislators cited in wanting to kill this deal. And they had tried, legislators had tried earlier to kill this deal. If you might recall, they had passed a bill that would change the way the Department of Administration disposes of state property. Interestingly enough, not a single mention was made of the ITD property when that bill passed the House overwhelmingly. It was only after that bill passed that House Speaker Mike Moyle said, yeah, this is, we're trying to kill the ITD deal. And so then that kind of threw things into chaos. They came back, legislators came back and put into two budget bills, the budget bill for ITD and the budget bill for the Department of Administration, basically a poison pill killing the deal to sell the land. Now, keep in mind that this property was already sold, or well, not already sold, but the bid was already awarded. And these three companies, Hawkins Companies, the Pacific Companies, and Utah-based FJ Management had, you know, they were ready to roll. They had put in their proposal and were going to get ready to develop this property. And then they did sign the deal last month in March. And so now, on the last days of the session, Governor Little has this bill, these budget bills before him, and he says it's unfair. And one of the arguments that he makes, and some legislators made, that you can't go back on a deal. You can't, how are people going to want to do business with the state of Idaho if you say you're going to do one thing and then the legislature comes back, you know, a few months later and says, no, deal's off, we're changing all the rules that you abided by and went through the process as we had prescribed earlier, and now we're going to change all the rules. And so Governor Little said it was unfair. So you might think, oh, well, he's going to veto it. Well, he did not sign it, nor did he veto it, which in effect makes that law go into effect. So it was kind of a cowardly way out of it without signing it or vetoing it. The Hawkins companies have already suggested that they are going to sue, which, I can't imagine that they wouldn't. They've already gone through this process and were awarded the bid. And so probably the next thing we're going to see on this deal is a lawsuit that the Idaho taxpayers are going to have to pay to defend.
So, what could happen next, I guess, in all of this, Scott? Because this is a mess.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would have to go back through whatever process, or they might need to come up with a whole new process for how they dispose of state property. Ostensibly, well, what the legislature wants to do is they want to keep the Transportation Department back in that building. And the bills that they passed directed the Idaho Transportation Department to go and refurbish this old building that apparently is in really bad shape and was damaged by floods a few years ago. So they want to keep that property. And I'll point out that this is 44 acres of state-owned property that's not on the tax rolls. If it were sold to a private developer, think about all the property taxes that would go on to. Think about all the sales tax from commercial development, the wages that are being promised from the construction jobs, all that stuff goes away. And even though the state legislature several years ago had purchased the Chinden campus just for this very purpose.
So, Kevin, as we talked about before the break, this year's legislative session, it's officially over. Yeah, you could officially say it was the 2024 legislative session. However, you wrote an article calling it Mike Moyle's session. Tell us what you mean by this.
Well, and I think it ties into what Scott was talking about with the showdown at the end of the session over ITD. Mike Moyle, the Speaker of the House, who is the most powerful legislator over there, and in some ways the most polarizing legislator over there. There's not a lot of middle ground about Mike Moyle. You're either a fan or you have real problems with the way he operates. Bottom line is, he got almost everything he wanted this legislative session. He got this complete overhaul of the way the Legislative Budget Committee operates, managed to get House leadership for the most part, and Scott mentioned Megan Blanksma being kicked out of leadership. Most of leadership came to his side on the changes in the budget process. House Bill 521, the facilities bill that we talked about in the first segment, that is a Mike Moyle invention to a large degree. It doesn't just put a lot of money into school facilities like we've never done in state history. It also reduces income taxes, which Mike Moyle likes to try to do pretty much every legislative session. It also eliminates a school election date. It does a lot of things. And there was a lot of grumbling at the state house about this bill that does a lot of different things, and we've got to vote for it to get the one thing we like, and we got to hold our nose and put up with everything that we don't like in this bill. Passed overwhelmingly. And Moyle was able to get that pushed through both houses to a large extent. And the ITD showdown, I mean, that was Moyle against Chuck Winder, Senate President Pro Tem, who was a staunch supporter of the sale of the State Street campus. And it was a showdown between Moyle and the governor, who, as Scott mentioned previously, the governor kind of shrugged and walked away from the fight over ITD, allowing those budgets to go into law without his signature. I mean, you can't argue that Moyle was not the defining figure of this session. Usually we, at the end of the session, we talk about, was it a good session for the governor? In the education space, we'll say, well, was it a good session for the state superintendent? This was all about Mike Moyle this session. And I don't think I can recall a session where one legislator was as singularly powerful as Moyle was this year.
That's a good point to make, though, Kevin, especially when you break it down like that.
Yeah, it was just, yeah. And he had a press conference at the end of the session on Wednesday, and I asked him about the session, but I also asked what he felt did not get done. And he said the thing that he really wants to get done, and he assures that it will get done in 2025 is something in the school choice arena. He says that issue is not going to go away, and whether that becomes a tax credit or it becomes a scholarship program or an education savings account, we'll see what sort of proposal comes down the pike. But he says that he's really serious about making that a priority next year, assuming he gets reelected, which is a, he still has to get through a primary and get through a general election.
So, Kevin, another thing I want to talk about is the fact that, okay, so we're just, a handful of days out from the session ending. Yet there's already some fallout from it. Can you explain this? Because this is in regards to the Pocatello-Chubbuck School District.
Yeah, and again, it's a fallout from House Bill 521, the facilities law. So the Pocatello School District, and we've talked about Pocatello's problems. We've talked about the really difficult situation they're dealing with because of the fire at Highland High School last year and trying to fix that school and trying to upgrade their facilities. A few weeks ago, trustees were kind of in a box. They had to decide whether to put a bond issue on the ballot in May. And there are deadlines. I mean, you can't just put a bond issue on the ballot at the last minute. They had to decide a few weeks ago whether to push for a bond issue. I think they were pushing for $33 million or hold off. They decided to put it on the May ballot, not knowing for sure what was going to happen with House Bill 521, not knowing for sure if the facilities money is going to come in. Well, Pocatello stands to receive $41 to $43 million, I want to say, from House Bill 521. Well, that's more than enough to cover what they were seeking in this bond issue. So Pocatello trustees have taken the rather unusual step of going out and saying to voters, don't vote for the bond issue in May. We don't need it anymore. We put it on the ballot because we wanted to have a backup plan in case money from the state came through. So, vote no on our bond issue.
Yeah.
you don't hear that very often. And, Pocatello voters rejected a bond issue in November. So, they may not need that much prodding to vote no again. But, wouldn't it be the most crazy Idaho election thing to happen for them to vote yes on this bond issue that the trustees are saying no to? No, seriously, I doubt it will pass. But it's an interesting sort of sidelight in this whole debate over facilities and who pays for them.
But I swear, Kevin, if it did pass, then they'd have to put a ballot on the then they'd have to put a measure on the ballot in November, saying never mind.
I mean, I don't even want to know how that plays out after that happens. I mean, I doubt it's going to come to that. I mean, you still need a 2/3 supermajority to pass any bond issue, and if you're basically telling people to not do this, I think they'll probably comply.
Yeah. Okay. So, Scott, back in 2019, a veterans home was supposed to be built in Boise. So let's fast forward to today. It's been 5 years. What is going on?
Yeah, Idaho was granted a grant in 2019 to build a new veterans home in Boise, now, along with dozens of other homes across the country. And so it took a while for Boise's, for Idaho's name to go to the top of the list. We finally got to the top of the list last year in 2023. And there was, you probably remember, that we all did stories on it, that we're going to get this new veterans home. And it was much celebrated. Finally got greenlit. But then it hit a snag. It turns out that in 2022, Congress passed a law called the Build America, Buy America Act. And basically that stipulates that any construction project that's funded by federal dollars must exclusively use domestically sourced materials. It's a great law, great idea, America first kind of thing. The only problem is that U.S. manufacturing really hasn't caught up yet. You can't just say in 2022, okay, now you've got to buy everything in America, and all of a sudden U.S. manufacturing can now produce all this stuff. There's many things that we cannot source in the United States, and that includes a lot of the construction materials that go into building this veterans home. And I talked to Mark Champel, the division director of the Division of Veteran Services, and he said, steel coil, HVAC equipment, electrical components, elevator units, all stuff that they couldn't buy. Congress was actually wise in passing that bill, saying you can get a waiver if there are things that you can't buy in the United States or if it's really expensive. And so folks in Idaho said, okay, well, we'll apply for a waiver. Well, unfortunately, the Veterans Affairs Department says we are not granting waivers At all for these entire infrastructure projects. You have to comply with the Build America, Buy America Act, or you can't build. And so Idaho has been very frustrated because they do qualify for these waivers if they were granted. They calculate that it would increase the cost by 28% to if they had to comply with the Build America, Buy America. And so they're really in a holding pattern. The Veterans Affairs Department informed Idaho officials in January that you've got until February 26 to figure this out, or else we're withdrawing the grant. And so in March, they informed Idaho, VA informed Idaho that they're withdrawing the grant. You cannot build the home.
Wow.
There are two last ditch efforts. They're going to try, Idaho officials are going to try to get a waiver on each of the individual items that they cannot source domestically. Mark Champel tells me it is thousands of items. They have to compile a list of thousands of items and apply for a waiver on each individual one of those. Now, even if they go through all that, it's not a certainty that the VA, which has taken a hardline stance on this, is going to grant those waivers. So the other last ditch effort is, you know how they say it's going to take an act of Congress to get this done? Well, there's an act of Congress that is making its way through Congress. U.S. Representative Russ Fulcher and U.S. Senator Jim Risch have introduced the Waiver Act. Senator Mike Crapo and Representative Mike Simpson have signed on as co-sponsors of the bill. And the Waiver Act would require the VA to grant waivers if the project was approved before BABA, Build America, Buy America, was passed, and if they were on the priority list before June of 2023, which the Boise Veterans Home qualifies for both of those. So, you know, whether they can get that passed quickly and quickly enough to make this thing happen, we'll see. But it's really an unfortunate situation because I visited with veterans who are living there, and they really deserve this new home. This home was built in 1965, and they have to share rooms. They share bathrooms with three other people. And you know, this has been in the plans for 5 years, and now it's just getting stymied by federal bureaucracy at the last minute.
Okay, thanks for that update, Scott. Hopefully that works out though, and this can be built. So Kevin, it is that time of year when high school seniors are only weeks away from graduation. So with that said, how do higher ed enrollment numbers look right now?
Well, they look pretty good. We looked at the spring numbers for this year and we compared them to what we saw a year ago. 7 of the 8 colleges and universities across the state saw their spring numbers increase from the spring of 2023. So it's kind of an apples to apples comparison. And what it means for like a Boise State University, they are up about 500 students from where they were last year. And they are now up above where they were in the spring of 2020 when everything went haywire. So increases across the system this year with one exception, and that would be North Idaho College, which has had so many issues over the past few years with questions about their accreditation. Their enrollment decline continued this spring. And I see officials are still hopeful, though, because they feel like they're seeing some promising signs. Their first-time student numbers increased quite a bit. So the new students that are coming in looking for a degree, those numbers have increased. So they're hoping that they're turning the corner a little bit on enrollment. But by and large, across the system, the enrollment numbers did increase.
Okay, good to know. Nicole, I have about 2 minutes left. Tell us about compost season, because it's starting up, and what folks need to know here in the Treasure Valley.
Sure. So I'll try and keep it brief. We have the compost program through the city of Boise. It lets Boise residents get 2 cubic yards per year of free compost. Obviously, you can be doing that all year round, but this is really when it starts to ramp up. So as you are mowing your lawn, pulling weeds, pruning things, all of those things, even weeds, even goat heads can go into your compost bin. The compost processes at a high enough temperature that those weed seeds are effectively killed. And then if you are wanting to go pick up your free compost, it is do it yourself. So bring a shovel and a truck or some kind of container. But there are 2 pickup locations. There's one over on Joplin Street in West Boise. And then at the Idaho Botanical Garden, you can also get your compost there.
Okay, I love that though. You better have your own shovel because they're not
Oh,
doing
yeah,
it
you
for
have
you.
to work for it.
Okay, all right. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming on today. Thank you all for being so involved in the legislative session. I hope you get some time to rest and recover. We have been talking with Nicole Blanchard, the Idaho Statesman Outdoors reporter, Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.